religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Universal Hive Mind. Today is December 22nd, 2022. Happy winter solstice. I'm your host, Nate Kapp, and welcome to the 58th Cubbyhole Podcast, where critical topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. The website for today's show is cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyHole.com. And if you prefer to listen to the show on a different platform, you can also listen with Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio, Pandora, Simplecast, YouTube, Odyssey, Minds, BitChute, and much more. So hopefully you guys are all doing well, and today we are going to jump into some very interesting allegories, and I would say these are archetypal universal allegories, or foundational allegories. Very important allegories dealing with Darwin's evolution theory, or human evolution theory, marriage, and UFOs, aliens, and the Greys. And hopefully no one gets too excited because I'm not going to actually get into any, you know, real data or real events that are dealing with these topics. What I'm really trying to do is bring something to the table that I haven't really heard anybody else talk about. And it's really from my own angle, what I'm seeing, and how there is great value in the allegories that I am taking away from these actual concepts, okay? So it's what I feel needs to be understood first and foremost allegorically, and also I feel like it's a good place in the progress of the show, okay? It kind of gives a little break in the show too, from going from the second degree to the third degree. And it does have something to do with these degrees, the first, the second, and third degree. Okay. So before I get into all that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the end of slavery summit that just took place the first half of this December 2022. Which was run by Corey Angelot and Aaron Butler. And they did a really great job. It was a very unique event or summit. There was lots of critical knowledge that was given about slavery, you know, what it is, why it's basically destroying us and, you know, pushing us in the direction of devolution, how it's generating more chaos. And also, it was all about freedom, obviously, because that's the goal, right? And so there were lots of solutions, lots of really great solutions. And I think it was a very, very, very important event. And I think that if you did not get a chance to watch these interviews, because that's basically what it was, is Corey was just interviewing everybody. And I gave my presentation within the interview, which was, you know, something I've actually done a couple times this year. And it's kind of an interesting, I really like giving a presentation in an interview, because then that way the person that's interviewing gets to intervene and gets to ask questions or, you know, give their input. So I gave my presentation titled Aim for Freedom, which was a symbolic breakdown to basically help the student realize the reference point in simple form. You know, the reference point being the purpose or the goal or truth or freedom, and helping put a finer point on why a symbol can help us be a guide by having lots of heritage within the symbol that helps us understand how valuable these, not only the symbol is, but the information that is attached to that symbol, you know, from our history up until now, right? So the more that we learn, especially because it's dealing with the circle dot or the point within a circle, which I haven't really got into deeply on this show yet, which I'm going to because we're going into the third degree, which is where the point within a circle is very, very important to understand within that degree. Okay. So if you're interested in that presentation, or my presentation, the Aim for Freedom, or the summit, the End of Slavery Summit, I'm going to leave both links in the description under show number 58 of the Cubbyhole website. So if you go to the top where it says episode 51 plus, and then scroll down to show 58, you'll see the description. And you'll see the slides too. So definitely go there because there's going to be slides for today's show. And you'll definitely want to follow along with those slides just so you can see what I'm presenting. And it is very, very important. So definitely make sure you're ready for that. Also, my girlfriend Cindy took me to go see Avatar 2 in 3D this past Sunday for my birthday. And it was I don't want to close your ears for a second because I'm going to kind of spoil it just a little bit. Not really, but I just want to give my little 30-second input. I thought that overall the movie was very well done. It was extremely beautiful to look at. It is just amazing. The CGI of today is just, it's just incredible. And I thought that the spiritual allegory was very, very well done. The only thing I had a problem with was I felt like the physics and, you know, some of the rules of the universe in the movie were off, and I thought maybe the story could have been wrote just a little bit better. I thought maybe it might have been rushed in a few areas, but overall, I thought it was really awesome. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it again in 3D because, I mean, that's the way James Cameron wanted it to be seen, both movies, Avatar 1 and 2, because of how beautiful it looks in 3D. But it was a great movie. I definitely recommend anybody who liked the first one who hasn't seen this one to go see it. And you know, it really has a lot to do with the spiritual awakening and, you know, what we go through. So, you know, and it's not really a new story either. So it's just told in a very unique way. So that's why I like it, and I think James Cameron did a pretty good job. Now, something important I'd like to put a finer point on before we go into the allegories is, well, I'd like to review a little of what was covered on the last show and put a finer point on a few of those things that I talked about. So I covered the Masonic Esoteric Second Degree Tracing Board, specifically the middle chamber. And then I got into corn symbolism. Well, you know, corn, wine, and oil symbolism. And then I got into the waterfall and how that is symbolic. And then I talked about Osiris, the corn god. And this is a very, very, I didn't really get into it too deep, but I just made mention of it because I think it's very important to understand Osiris a lot further, being a corn god, because, you know, we've briefly talked about Osiris in different phases of the year through the zodiac, the science of the zodiac. But I think it's important to also understand Osiris as the corn god, which can be further understood by reading and studying The Golden Bough by James Frazier. And I think it's a very critical book to own because it is dealing with the rituals that we're going to have to deal with and learn if we're really going to understand the evolution of the rituals from the stellar into the solar. Okay. And that's how I understand it. And then I got into the Golgotha symbolism and there being a correspondence to the mound or skull and temple in the tracing boards, especially just say a Boehring's second degree tracing board and the from darkness to light tracing board, the big one, how the mound looks like a skull. So if you know, you really do have to think abstractly. And I know that can be very difficult for some people, but you just have to remember if there's a mound or a temple, that is akin to a skull. And you have to remember that the blood of Christ is the death. It is a death of the material self. It's the blood that, you know, pours down the skull. And this is what can be regenerated to renew ourselves spiritually. Okay, because this is about the rebirth. And then I talked about, so this is where I got into the sacred secretion or the, you know, the pineal fluid being the potential renewal oil or blood that can activate higher frequencies in the brain, basically to, you know, discover the Holy of Holies, which is veiled in the middle or the central point of the mind or heart, the middle chamber. Okay. And I just want to take a minute to talk about this secretion a little bit more, okay? There's ways that this has been said, and I think it's important to understand from a biological point of view and also an allegorical perspective. Now, how I explained that on the last show was from both the biological understanding and really more so from an allegorical perspective. Okay. Both are important, but the allegory is something that I feel like anyone can see if they actually do the real work and really learn how to see allegorically. But the biological part is and can be harder to know, and it becomes very ambiguous because it's an occult anatomy. It's something that most of us are never going to see. It's something that we have to learn through science, learn through biology, learning our biology, learning our inner anatomy, and then learning how to understand physics, learning how to understand something so sacred that's been said many, many times all through history. From all parts of the world, and really try to put it all together for ourselves to really see this, you know, inner journey, right? This symbolic inner journey, and I guess this real journey of this fluid, which is very interesting because it does make sense because we really do release serotonin and melatonin from our pineal gland that does really actually go down our spine and, you know, through our nerves. And this can be harvested into, you know, a certain type of rebirth in the self to raise that fluid back up to our brain to give us, renewed energy. So it's important to hear all the different interpretations, but to really hone in on the simple story of death, rebirth, and growth of the inner hero. So it's about death of the younger, lower material self, right? And rebirth of the hero self, the spiritual seeker for truth and love and freedom. You know, the one who truly realizes purpose and creation and has an appreciation for creation and the creator, right? So since we're on the winter solstice in the northern hemisphere, this is in alignment with this fluid or sacred secretion falling, you know, alignment to fall down to the sacrum energy center, right? The sacred energy center where there awaits a seed of the true self to be reborn, to be activated, to be alchemically raised, right? Because remember, it's about our material mind self dying. That is what is falling. That is what is falling from our mind. Our material mind is falling. It's dying, right? And if it stays down in the base or down in the sacrum or down in the root energy center, this is where we can just stay in our base desires and we don't grow, right? Because we can get stuck there. We can fall. We can have our fall and we can get stuck there. And we can even die because of this. Or, and I even kind of look at this symbolically referencing the hitting rock bottom. You know, so if you're falling, you can hit your rock bottom and then you can bounce up, right? And this is typically what happens in a lot of us, because what happens is we suffer so much, we hit our rock bottom, and some of us die, actually physically die, or some of us kind of emerge from that just enough to so we can survive, or some of us, very few of us, unfortunately, rise up as the hero from the ashes to do something selflessly to help end so much of the suffering in this world by ending the suffering of the self, right? So helping ending the suffering of the self, then not only because we're all connected, that helps the aggregate suffering lessen, but then you can actually go out into the world and do these teachings to help others help themselves become less in their own suffering, right? So this is what this is about. And by doing that, that's what helps the land, right? Because this is all about the alchemical activation of the inner self. This is about alchemically going from the base to the gold. You know, the base, the roots of the self to the gold of the self, to the pineal, right? To the throne of the higher self. You know, we can stay on the lower throne in base desires, or we can raise ourselves spiritually to the throne of the higher self. And that's the alchemical raise. That's the alchemical raise of light. That's the alchemical rays of consciousness, right? So it's an inner alchemy. It's about nourishing this beautiful internal spiritual seed through alchemy. And the ancient Egyptian masons, they understood this very science, this inner science. They understood it really well because at the least, at the very least, they knew that correspondence as a spiritual tool, that if the self is well, if the self is healed, then the land becomes healed. The land becomes well, right? So this is why understanding the Ishtas fish, or the fisher king or fisherman story, is so vital, because it's a corresponding inner science that reflects the health of the land, internal and external. It's a mirror science. It's a reflection science. And the stellar Masonic priests of ancient Egypt, they preserved this science in what we understand is the fisher king, or the fish man, or the crocodile man glyphs, the glyphs in the stellar mythos. And this took place, you know, 200 to 300,000 years ago, when they were preserving this science, where Horus and Set were, where they first emerged. And this, you know, this is according to what I've learned from Albert Churchward. So these twins were birthed from the Great Mother, the Great Mother Bird. And, you know, symbolically, right? So Set being or representing darkness, right? The dry lands, the fire, the decay. So that would be akin to, you know, this lower self, right? And Horus is the light. Horus represents the light. Horus represents the replenishment. He is the replenisher. He's the nourisher. He's the hero. This is about understanding, you know, what I talked about on the last show, Sebek Horus, the original fish man in the stellar mythos. Okay? So this is about understanding that these inner sciences, because that's what they are, these glyphs from ancient Egypt back in the stellar cult or the stellar mythos, this was preserved to help us understand the inner science of the self, to understand our soul, right? To help us understand our soul so that way we could be the true stewards of this earth. That's what creates a healthy land, a healthy environment, a healthy community. And if anybody's really paying attention, there really isn't very much health in our communities. There really isn't that much health in, you know, true health, where we're not really raising in consciousness collectively in our communities. The health of the land comes from the health of the you. So the more that you become healthy, the more that the land becomes healthy, and the more that your surroundings become healthy. That's what these sciences are trying to help us understand, because it's about reconnecting to source, reconnecting to nature. So when we do this, what we're doing is we're becoming beings that are influencing positive change into our surroundings by making ourselves better, right? So this information is very crucial, okay? This information is extremely crucial. And a lot of people don't really understand a lot of this knowledge. And, you know, it comes, like I said, it comes from so many different angles and so many different teachings and so many different interpretations. But I think it's important to get back to the origins of this type of information so we really understand where it is coming from. Okay. And, you know, when I'm talking about the stellar mythos, I know it's been said on here a few times on the show, but I just want to really make it clear that when we're talking about the stellar mythos, We're talking about pre-solar mythos, which means it's way before Osiris. Osiris comes at the Osiris cult or Osiris myth comes at the end of the solar cult. So it's closer to us. Okay, we're in the solar cult right now. We're in the solar cult umbrella in the whole world right now. It is the most dominant cult in the world. So we have to understand that Osiris is kind of the focal point that most people fixate on, or what they focus on the most when it comes to our history. They go back to Osiris, and then they're like, well, there's nothing past that. There's nothing beyond that. No, there really is a lot more beyond that. So we have to get past this. Well, it's not that we have to get past Osiris, but we have to study Osiris to recognize where it comes from. Because this is what's going to help us understand what took place beyond that to help us understand why we're in the condition that we're in today. Okay? It's very, very important. So I'm going to go ahead and go on to the first slide for today's show. So I want you to go to the slide that says Gerald Massey and his quote. It's very, very important. And it's really interesting. In his book, Ancient Egypt, The Light of the World, he wrote... He wrote a very powerful poem involving this sacred science that I'm talking about. He says, quote, Horus the Savior, who was brought to birth as light in heaven and sustenance on earth. Horus in spirit, verily divine, who came to turn the water into wine. Horus, who gave his life and sowed the seed for men to make the bread of life indeed. Horus, the comforter, who did descend in human fashion as the heavenly friend. Horus, the word, the founder in his youth. Horus, fulfiller as the word made truth. Horus, the Lord and leader in the fight against the dark powers of the ancient night. Horus, the sufferer with his cross bowed down, who rose at Easter with his double crown. Horus, the pioneer who paved the way of resurrection to eternal day. Horus, triumphant with the battle done, Lord of two worlds, united and made one. And he's talking about this internal science of the sacred oil, an allegorical journey of the hero. I mean, it's a lot more than that, but I'm saying we have to see it that way. And this science comes way before the science of Jesus Christ, which comes from the science of Horus. And Horus comes from the stellar mythos. So we have to understand Horus comes down and changes in types as the hero from the stellar into a hero in the solar. But it's very important to see all the zootypes that Horus takes shape in. Okay, because Horus can be a hippopotamus. The Horus can be, or, you know, Horus can be a crocodile, or Horus can be, you know, a hawk or a falcon. So we have to really orient ourselves and see how Horus takes these different roles and changes. So we can really see how this archetype is used in different ways to help us understand different elemental powers in nature, okay? And help us understand you know, different attributes of different animals and what they mean. Okay. So if you don't have this book, The Light of the World by Gerald Massey, definitely make sure to get this book, whether it's in PDF form or physical. I have a physical copy. It's not the original, but it's definitely worth owning if you really want to understand especially the evolution of the solar mythos. And Gerald Massey's opus is very crucial to understanding this solar mythos, especially. Okay. So if we really want to understand this inner spiral spiritual journey, then we're going to need to learn the science of the stellar, the solar, and the lunar mythos. We're going to need to understand the knowledge of the Fisher King and King Arthur and the science of the zodiac through understanding astrotheology. And of course, understanding, you know, enough of the occult anatomy of the human body. And definitely the mystery traditions such as tarot, Kabbalah, and Freemasonry. And we're going to eventually get into tarot and Kabbalah as we move through these shows. But, you know, it's a constant unfoldment. And the more knowledge that we bring to the information of the self, you know, the more that we bring knowledge to the information that is presented, the more we'll see what is veiled. We'll be able to see past the veil or what's underneath the veil. And, you know, what's been covered, what's been hidden from us for thousands of years. And this is what frees us from being slaves to this information. Because this information, all of this information, is being used against us in one form or one way or another. So we have to become conscious of this knowledge, so that way we become less of a slave to others. So we can break free from so much of this mind control that's been on our minds for thousands of years. We have to break free from it. And, you know, natural law, a lot of people are learning natural law and they think that, well, once I learn the difference between right and wrong, that's it. No, natural law is an unfoldment. And it keeps going and going and going. And we keep learning and learning and learning. And I mean, some people just want to be left alone and they should be left alone, but we got to get more people involved to learn not only natural law at the foundation, but we have to learn the unfoldment of natural law, because the unfoldment of natural law is the unfoldment of the soul. And so as we keep learning more and more and more, what it's really doing is it's not just an unfoldment of natural law or the soul. It's also a constant unveiling of all the lies that have been put over our eyes for thousands of years that are keeping us from evolving as a sovereign human being, as a sovereign human society, or a sovereign human consciousness. So if we are going to really take ourselves serious in becoming free, we're going to have to learn these sciences. Okay? And yes, you know, natural law is first and foremost. We do have to learn the science of morality if we're going to get through this, if we're going to get through this together. You know, we meet on the level. We meet at natural law. Natural law is the crux of finding truth, right? But we're going to have to go further than that. We're going to have to use natural law to go further in our work, to see where it takes us, to really see all the way back to the origins of where slavery really started, okay? By the corruptions, because the corruptions are what create slavery. And we have to get through those corruptions. We have to become conscious of those corruptions, and we have to make things right. And that's a lot of work, but we have to do it if we want to get out of this enormous solar slave system. Okay? We have to learn this information. We have to become conscious of this information if we really want to evolve out of this cage that we're all part of. Okay? So, as we move through these shows, there will be put a finer point on this specific information. Always. Because that's what we know and understand, and we're going to continue to put a finer point on all this information because it is an unfoldment and it is very difficult to deal with. But it is the right direction. Absolutely, it's the right direction, okay? Because once you dive into it and you really see what's happening spiritually, you know, on a, you know, with consciousness, then you will see, oh, this has to be known. This has to be taken more serious. Because, yes, it is, everybody has their own perspective of what has taken place and their own perspective with this type of knowledge. But the more that we are taking this knowledge serious, the more we're all starting to hone in on the same thing. We're all going, you know, in a very similar direction towards truth. Truth is all that matters. Now, just remember, this is all part of understanding the occult and, you know, through symbolism and through allegory. So, I'm going to go ahead and jump into the allegorical breakdowns for today's show. And again, I'm going to talk about Darwin's evolution theory or human evolution theory, marriage, UFOs, aliens, and the Greys, and basically in that order. Okay. So just to reiterate what an allegory is, just go to the next slide. And it states that it is a figurative or cryptic poem, story, or picture that can be interpreted or decoded in order to disclose a hidden meaning, generally a moral lesson. Okay? And now we're going to go to the next slide that says allegory, metaphorical vehicles, and tenors. And I mentioned both of these in earlier shows, but I just want to go over it again just so you get ourselves re-familiar with these terms, just so we're on the same page. So an allegory can also be understood through metaphorical tenors and vehicles, right? So the tenor is the hidden cryptic idea within the vehicle, which is the outer exoteric part of the story or poem or picture. And this is used to describe the tenor, the hidden concept, the hidden idea within the vehicle. Okay. So if we think of Darwin's evolution theory and marriage and aliens and Greys as only, you know, literal, then we only see the vehicle with no tenor, right? No allegory, no lesson, no growth, right? We don't see the hidden concept or the hidden idea, if there is any, right? We should always be looking for the hidden idea or the hidden concept. If you're truly studying the occult, that's what you're doing constantly, because there is so much hidden within different ideas and different concepts, right? So we have to be ready to see the tenor, to see the idea, to see the concept hidden within the vehicle, right? So what I'm not going to do is get into any actual events or actual historical evidence or any sightings or any, you know, crazy theories for these topics, okay? I'm only going to share what I know to be, you know, not only true within the allegory, but what is valuable about what is actually important regarding these topics, okay? So the serious student will quickly realize how valuable it is to see these allegories because they help us get closer to what? Truth, right? Rather than, you know, endlessly try to prove whether there's anything actual in them in the historical, you know, literal sense. Because it's to help us see the spiritual relevance for, you know, transformation to the higher self. That's it. As far as I'm concerned, that's what it's really about. So, and that's what it should be about. If marriage and, you know, UFOs and aliens and Darwin's evolution theory aren't helping us spiritually, then that's because we're not looking at them through a spiritual lens. We're not looking at them through a symbolic or allegorical lens. Okay. So, I mean, because honestly, none of those things really helped me personally until I started getting into the world of the occult and really understanding allegory. So if you can go to the slide that says Allegory of Darwin's Human Evolution Theory, the one with the totem pole, and you'll see the T-Rex. Now, I want to be clear by stating that I do not ascribe to Darwin's evolution theory, okay? As far as I know, as far as I understand, there really isn't any true evidence that humans evolved from apes. So, it's mostly just theory, and there are lots of missing links. Okay, and I'm not saying I have fully looked into Darwin's work completely, you know. I mean, I want to say definitely that I'm not trying to put his work in vain, because that man did a lot of work really trying to prove something that I think is very valuable in a lot of ways. And, you know, the way people have taken his theory and run with it has been very dangerous. I just think that, you know, what's important is to see this allegorically, okay? So this brings me to what helps us gain something more from Darwin's human evolution theory, which is, you know, we should be thinking of this theory as something like the totem pole, right? So if you look at the totem pole, you see the human like figure sitting with the little person being held underneath. So it's like a baby, right? There's a baby being held by a dragon. So a dragon represents what? A reptile. And then above that is bird head with wings, right? And this is a correspondence to human consciousness. That's how we have to understand this. I mean, that's what it was made for. If we really truly are studying consciousness, if we're really truly studying the attributes and aspects of animals and the animal kingdom, if we're really truly studying the triune brain, then we will really see that this is an archetype of human consciousness. Now, I'm not going to recite Darwin's human evolution theory verbatim, okay? What I'm going to do is add on, or, you know, kind of fill in the gaps, as Darwin would say, in order to prove my point and express the allegory that I'm presenting, the allegory that I see. Okay, so this is my perspective, but it's a perspective based on actual information that comes from these topics. Okay, so don't hold me to anything as, you know, saying anything historically factual here. Okay, that's not what I'm trying to bring to the table. Okay, that can be for another episode. I'm only taking points that I have learned about Darwin's evolution theory, you know, with along with humans, and I see something more valuable that makes more sense when it's told in allegorical form. Okay? And you know, since atheists, if not all atheists, typically believe in this material-based theory, I'm going to add the Big Bang theory as the starting point. So it's not all completely, you know, Darwin evolution theory. Okay, so I'm gonna tell this evolution story in an allegorical way, but also I want the listener to listen literally too. Okay, remember I said we should always be listening allegorically and literally at the same time. You know, and like I said, this is my angle. This is my way of seeing this evolution theory allegorically. All right. And also, I think it's important to look at this word evolution. You know, people tend to think changes in the material is the only way for evolution to actually take place. You know, so this is if you're in a materialistic mindset, this is how people typically think, especially in the age of any type of technology, like in the past 200 years or even the past 100 years, people equate technology as a form of human evolution. And that's completely not true. It might be evolution of the technology, because yes, technology is always evolving, but that does not equate to human evolution at all. I mean, it can help human evolution. If people were actually using their computers and phones to read information and learn, it could definitely advance us way faster, because we have all the information at our fingertips. But people are so entertained and, you know, so lazy that, you know, most just ignore this evolution that could take place, spiritual evolution. So when you look at the definition of evolution, well, one of the definitions states that it is the gradual development of something, especially from a simple to a more complex form. Okay, so it's not, you know, that particular definition is not stating material evolving to more material. It is a very broad definition. It means, you know, something like consciousness could be developed from something simple to more complex. Right? So we have to learn that evolution is not just based in material. Okay? And I'm not trying to, you know, knock the idea of there being material evolution. Okay? I'm not against that idea. I'm definitely not studied in that area. But I also know that there is a lot of evidence that shows that, you know, material does evolve in certain ways over time. Okay? But what's the most important thing is to recognize that consciousness is what we should be evolving. Because as we evolve inwardly, we manifest evolution outwardly. Okay? So we really have to understand that. That's one of the things that makes us humans so special, so interesting. And we have a lot of power in that way. Okay? And that power can be used for good or it can be used for awful things. So what I want people to understand is that when we're trying to understand Darwin's human evolution theory, we should be thinking about the triune brain. Okay? Because the triune brain is about going from the R complex, you know, raising consciousness through the mammalian brain to the neocortex. So it's raising up, and that's how we should be thinking about it, you know, symbolically, especially. So I want you to go to the slide that says Allegory of Darwin's Human Evolution Theory, if you're not there already, okay? And I know right away, I've had this happen to me many times when I've tried to tell this allegory, either to, you know, Christian religion extremists or super left-brain atheists, that, you know, as soon as I've tried to tell them this allegory, they immediately say, well, you know, the religionists, you know, the religion extremists say that there's no way that that could be true or that could have any validity because evolution isn't something that we believe in, right? They don't believe in evolution. They just throw that out. They throw that whole idea out the window. And then atheists, not all atheists have been this way, but a lot of them, they really completely dismiss this idea of an allegorical perspective of Darwin's human evolution theory, because they see it as something, you know, just made up like the Bible, right? That takes the attention away from the actual material evolution, because that's what they're stuck in. They're stuck in the material idea. They're stuck in the material ideology. So we have to see that if you're very, you know, if someone's coming at this allegory from a very right brain perspective, where they're rooted in some kind of religion like, you know, Christianity in a very extreme way, they're probably going to dismiss this because they don't believe in evolution. They believe only in creationism. And then atheists are typically coming from a left brain modality, and they see this as just some, you know, made up story like the Bible. That's how they look at it. They look at it like, oh, it's just, you know, you're trying to make something up to take away the attention off of what actually matters, which is material. Because that's the only way that they see. They're looking through their five senses only. They're not seeing the idea of internal evolution as a mirror reflection of this theory as an idea for an internal evolution. They're not seeing that. They dismiss that right away because they're very trapped in that left-brained modality. So, you know, I'm not dismissing the idea of natural selection, but what we have to understand is this idea of social Darwinism is one of the biggest problems in the world. Okay? And a lot of atheists take this position because social Darwinism goes hand in hand with this idea of Darwin's human evolution theory. because we have to understand that if we are in the belief of materialism, of actual material evolution, then what we fall into as a cult is this idea that the most ruthless gets to rule over others, or, you know, it's this dog eat dog mentality. So this is something that's been a very big problem in our world for a very, very long time. And if we can understand this theory, this human evolution theory in an allegorical form, I think it can really help us understand that if we go a certain direction, we can turn into a social Darwinist. We can turn into someone who is extreme in the material belief. So let me just go ahead and get into this allegory, okay? So just imagine the Big Bang, where all life began, right? Well, we can look at this as the intercourse Big Bang of mother and father, you know, where they co-create another human being, right? And so from that point, we can look at the smallest life in water, like, you know, tadpoles, right? Tadpoles being like sperm that meet the egg and then turn into what? A fish, like a baby self growing in the water of the womb, right? So once this fish starts to grow limbs, because this fish is getting ready to, you know, go on to land, right? Well, it's just like a baby starting to grow its limbs in the womb. They're both swimming around in the womb, right? So the fish is growing these limbs, getting ready to go on dry land. And so is the little baby self. So once there is a birth of this fish or the baby self, the human baby self, then the fish and the baby, think about them as one, come out of the womb or out of the water breaks, and the fish comes out onto land, right? The baby comes out into the dry world, right? And it's connected with an umbilical cord. And it's, you know, the baby doesn't, you know, know what to do, right? But it's still connected to the umbilical cord. Well, I mean, that's like a fish. A fish needs water still. So, you know, the fish can go, you know, if the fish is trying to become some kind of land animal at some point. See, it's really hard to imagine that, but it's easier to imagine it in this spiritual evolution, right? But the point is that once that umbilical cord is cut, the baby is, you know, on the ground, not knowing how to use its limbs yet. Well, look at a fish when it's on dry land. It doesn't know what to do except for flop around and hope that it gets back into the water, right? Well, let's imagine that fish is somehow able to breathe air now, or the baby is able to, you know, once the umbilical cord is cut, the baby is, you know, breathing air. And then, you know, after what, like 6-7 months, the baby is crawling. Well, the fish is on all fours crawling just like a baby, but the fish turns into a reptile, right? So the reptile is equivalent to the baby on all fours crawling on the ground, right? And from this point, there are two ways that a human can go. A human can be raised in ego, and stay in the material realm, because typically when we're young, we're definitely raised, most of us are raised in a materialistic mindset, but also because we are in our lower self. We don't start out as, you know, spiritual beings that know so much information and, you know, automatically know how to align to nature necessarily. I mean, yes, we are programmed to be the opposite because obviously we're in a control system. So nature is inverted to, you know, ego control. So we typically are raised with the mindset of believing in external government. So this is based in materialism. And this is where there is spiritual death. And we can become... So Darwin, he kind of talks about dinosaurs. And I think it's just because dinosaurs weren't such a big thing back then to talk about, because people were still, archaeologists were still finding dinosaur bones all over the world at that time. But the point is that if you think about dinosaurs being in that, because dinosaurs came from lizards, that's the idea. The idea is, or the theory is, that dinosaurs evolved from lizards because they are giant lizards themselves. So lizard is equated with the ego. Lizard is equated, you know, with the R complex, the reptile brain of the human brain, of the triune brain, right? So if we think of the reptile, you know, growing into this big monstrous lizard, especially the Tyrannosaurus Rex, because Tyrannosaurus Rex is like the most vicious of all. It is the king. There's a reason it's the Rex. It's the king of the dinosaur kingdom, right? So it is the ruler of the dinosaur kingdom, but it is a very violent creature, right? So this is akin to external government. And there's no coincidence that external government, when it becomes really big, inflated, ego inflated, it is a tyrannical government. It is tyranny. You know, tyrannical Saurus Rex, right? So if we understand how we can either become government, where we want to externally control others, or be supporters of government, you know, statists. This is what leads to human slavery. This is human slavery. We're in human slavery because so many people believe in this. So we haven't even got out, collectively, we have not got out of this R complex belief system. The dominators of this world are connected. They are operating out of our complex to the whole control system. They're at the top of the apex of the, you know, the pyramid control system. That's what this external Tyrannosaurus Rex is, because it's an inflated ego of control. So that's one direction that we can go, right? Or, so, you know, and that's part of Darwin's theory, right? But we can also turn into, you know, rodents and marsupials and apes, and then into human form. But, you know, I wanted to say something about, it's very interesting when we're, you know, little babies crawling around on all fours. We are like mice. We like to go hide in things, right? And then we get a little older and we start walking. We're playing on the ground. Our hands are always on the ground, like a monkey, right? And we're jumping on things and swinging on things and pushing things over. And we're wild. We're wild little monkeys when we're kids, when we're little children, right? And then as we start to grow into our teens and then into our 20s, we start to finally walk upright spiritually, right? We start to walk upright. And I mean, even in some ways, we're walking upright physically too, because, you know, when we're kids, we literally are on all fours. And when we're a little older, we really are playing on our hands and being wild on our hands. When we get older, when we get to be adults, we're not playing on our hands anymore like we used to. We really do have the ability to start walking upright. Now, this is about moving into the limbic system, you know, where we start to develop our emotions, where we start to develop our, you know, this is our mammalian part of our brain, the mid part of our brain. This is the middle. You could even say this is kind of like akin to maybe the middle part of our life in some way, right? But if we're evolving as a species, that means that we're going towards freedom. That means that we're aligning to natural law. That means that we're trying to do the right thing, and we actually are doing the right thing. And so if we go far enough back into ancient Egypt, where they have bird-headed people, this is akin to being spiritually levitated, because birds are the only beings, most birds are the only beings that can levitate and leave the material world, the terrestrial. You know, I mean, I'm not saying they completely leave it, because they're still in the atmosphere, right? But my point is that they can leave the material. They can defy gravity by flying upward. Well, we as human beings have the ability to become bird-headed. And I think we can even go further than that, okay? But the point is that, you know, you look at this totem pole in the bottom left, that is what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get, we're raise consciousness and activate our, you know, use our neocortex, the higher order thinking, you know, the newer part of the brain. So you have the R complex, which is the lower part, the oldest part of the brain, then the limbic system in the middle, and then you have the neocortex, the newer part. So when the hemispheres are together, this is, you know, when they're activating together, when they're in unison, when we're having, you know, an alchemical marriage, this is the internal spiritual evolution. This is about being in alignment to natural law, understanding the science of morality, right? So this is my interpretation of the allegory of Darwin's human evolution theory. And I think it is, I think it's legitimate. I think it makes the most sense. And like I said, I'm not trying to put his work in vain. I think there is something very interesting and very important about Darwin's work that we have learned from and that we will continue to learn from. I just think that the way that it's being used in today's climate, especially socially, is very dangerous. Okay? And it is what leads to more and more enslavement if we continue to think in this materialistic mindset. We can't throw creationism out, and we can't throw evolution out. We have to learn how to see them together. We have to learn how to recognize that there's a lot more to this picture than we see, especially when we're looking at it literally. If we're only looking at it through the lens of material, then we're not going to learn anything, and we're going to stay stagnated, and we're going to never evolve. And, you know, something I want to say also is that, you know, when you think of dinosaurs, a lot of people don't believe in dinosaurs. But that's not what matters. It's just about understanding, well, if Darwin or anyone fits in dinosaurs into this picture of evolution, then we're going to have to deal with it. We're going, you know, here's the other thing. Think about it. If dinosaurs went extinct, what can we learn from that as a human species if we include dinosaurs in the allegory of consciousness of a human being? Well, that means that if we continue on this path of being tyrannical, we can go extinct. Right? So that's very, very important to see that distinction and to see that that direction, right? And I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen. I'm just saying, like, we have to look at it that way, because it is something that is in our history that we have to deal with. It is something that is academically accepted, and it does make sense in this spiritual form, in this spiritual allegory. It does make sense. So if it makes sense, then that means that there's validity to it being this, you know, real thing that we have to pay attention to. Okay. And here's the other thing, before I move on to the next allegory, is Darwin and many others believe that birds evolved from dinosaurs. And, you know, just because, I mean, here's the thing. I don't believe in that theory at all, actually. I don't think anything aligns with that. I do see birds that have characteristics of, you know, a reptile and bird. I see that. But I don't see the in between. I don't see the real connection. And I do think, like, it's good to look at it that way, but to not accept it as, you know, having any real validity. I'm not telling you what to believe. I'm just saying I don't accept it as having any real validity. However, I do think that there is a way for dinosaurs, if you become tyrannical, that you spiritually could evolve into a bird head. Or maybe you become a reptile that's flying around. You could even equate that to the dark occult, who has the power of bird head to be able to levitate spiritually, but also has the, you know, the government control. You could look at it that way. I don't have a problem with that, but I think, you know, to try to say, like, Tyrannosaurus Rex just, you know, over time became a bird, a little pigeon or something, it just, I have trouble with that one. So, and I know there's millions, billions of years of evolution, supposedly, and fine, maybe it is true. But I don't see the links. I don't see the in-betweens. So it is very interesting, though. I highly recommend anybody listening who has not studied Darwin theory or hasn't looked into his work, I definitely recommend it, because I think it is very important to study, to at least become conscious of it, because I think it does have some very interesting perspectives on reality that we should look into. But again, I think that seeing the allegory, seeing the spiritual evolution and consciousness, I think that is what is most important first and foremost. Okay. Now I'm going to go ahead and move on to marriage. And this isn't going to be about, you know, when the first marriage between two people was, okay? So just make sure to go to the slide that says allegory of marriage. And this could also be, you know, symbol of marriage, right? But I'm saying allegory because we have to understand that, you know, allegory and symbolism are synonymous in some ways. But you have to understand that marriage is one of the most beautiful personal ceremonies or rituals that anyone could ever experience in their life. Okay? Internally, especially. So real quick, if you go to the next slide that says seeing allegorically, what I'm talking about is the internal esoteric alchemical bond between the right and left hemisphere of the brain. So basically the joining of the neocortex at the corpus callosum, right in the middle of the brain, where both the right brain and the left brain are joined. Okay. So this is the place where the sacred feminine right brain and sacred masculine left brain unify in the middle to cause light and harmony and evolution of consciousness. So this is the true light or white wedding, the alchemical wedding. And if you haven't got a chance to see the movie The Money Pit, this is an excellent allegorical alchemical wedding movie. And I made this slide probably back in, you know, when I made the allegory and tenor and vehicle slides. Okay. So this is just to help us understand the exoteric and the esoteric. So if you've seen the movie They Live, it's about understanding how to see both ways, how to see the exoteric, the outer, what everybody sees, and then putting on the glasses or, you know, seeing with your eye would be the esoteric, right? To see what's really going on. You know, if you look at the Money Pit picture, that's the vehicle. So the tenor would be the top part where I show, you know, the sacred masculine left brain and the sacred feminine right brain coming together with the sacred union, the whole brain, the alchemical marriage, right? So this is about seeing allegorically. And this is the place of gold, okay? Between the two pillars. The G is between the two pillars. And this is the goal. That's why they call it a goal post in football. Between the two golden pillars, where you can make 3 points, you know, the spiritual number 3. So it's very interesting in football because you have typically 7 points, which is, you know, the 6 would be the touchdown, then the 1, the 6 and the 1, you know, the 1 point after the touchdown is the field goal, the extra point, right? So you have the 7 and the 3 constantly in that game. Very spiritual numbers, right? But anyway, I digress. At the deepest level, this is the sacred geometry that we are all trying to align to, which is love. It's God. It's the creator, right? That's what we're trying to align to. Or it's the generative expression of true care. This marriage takes care. It takes care to have balance and equilibrium. That's also what it means. It's a full-time magnum opus, a full-time great work, the great work, right? So in esoteric Freemasonry, the sun and moon, when they're, you know, merging together, is the Masonic or alchemical wedding, right? The sun being the sacred masculine, and then the moon being the sacred feminine. And when we actually watch the solar eclipse, so let's go back to the slide that says allegory of marriage. So when we watch this solar eclipse, you know, where the moon passes over the sun, when the moon covers the sun, or when it veils the sun, this is akin to the alchemical wedding. This is when the moon perfectly covers the sun. And then there's this beautiful sparkle of light that typically occurs from one small point of the sun's rays that breaks free, that comes around the moon's surface, right? So you'll see a whole warm, basically like a golden ring of light around the moon, and then one bright sparkle that twinkles like a bright star, and it's very bright and almost like a white light at one point of the moon's outer edge. And it kind of creates this, you know, diamond-like ring or this diamond-like sparkle, right? You know, it's a sun gold ring with a bright white light diamond sparkle. And this is the wedding ring. This is nature's wedding ring. This is where it comes from. This is where we get this diamond ring, the gold and diamond ring. And because the male is associated with being an active principal, he initiates the invite of the lifelong bond to the female. But, you know, by the traditional way of getting on one knee and offering the marriage, asking to be married and offering the marriage ring. See, the reason the male is the one who puts the ring on the female, on the female's finger, and not the other way around, is because the sun is masculine. And the sun puts its ring of light around the moon. That's what the sun actually does. When you are watching the solar eclipse, the sun puts that ring of light around the moon. You know, at least from our perception on Earth, right? And then also, diamonds are what? They're forever, right? Just as the dance of the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine all through the universe. Because it's about understanding the yin-yang, or the circle dot, the symbolic ring of balance within. Because that's what marriage is about. It's about a balance. It's about a dance, a balanced dance between the female and the male, the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine. And this has nothing to do with institutionalized legal marriage, which is, you know, basically just an appeal to authority. You know, it's we have to understand it's not an externalized material monetary agreement or covenant, which is what the exoteric physical marriage has turned into, where we need the state to be you know, in between us. You know, marriage should never be between you and your partner and the state. That's not true marriage. That's slavery. 100%, that is slavery. Okay? It should never involve any third party. Marriage should never involve the state. It should never involve the government. Ever. Marriage is a very sacred bond, first and foremost, internally, spiritually, between the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Okay? So we really have to understand that. And then if we are married to our partner externally, that's it. That's the sacred marriage. That's the sacred bond externally. And it shouldn't have anyone else in between. And this is why, in my opinion, if anyone is wanting to marry someone, or they already married, or you know, they're already married and don't understand these occult mystery traditions, then what they are doing is they're living more in the material mindset by allowing the state to intervene and allowing ignorance to stagnate the marriage to stagnate the marriage growth, because marriage can't truly grow and be healthy without both partners working on themselves. The relationship becomes either, you know, stagnant, if both aren't working on themselves individually, or it becomes spiritually lopsided if, you know, one of the partners is working on themselves and the other isn't. So we have to recognize this, and we have to understand that it takes work. You know, I mean, that's why any relationship, not just marriages, they take work. But in a marriage, it really does. If you're making this promise or vow to be with each other eternally, then it's going to take lots of work on the self. And most people are not willing to do that. Most people are not willing to put in that hard work to have their own internal marriage to help the actual physical marriage between them and someone else, right? And if we correspond this to our inner temple and our two pillars, right? The sacred feminine and the sacred masculine pillars, then we can see that if we don't work on our aspects of our inner pillars, our brain hemispheres, then we never really have a wedding internally, and we stay living dualistically and internally apart, which is basically what always leads to internal chaos, living in dualism. If we only work on one hemisphere, so for example, if we individually only work on the left brain and gain lots of knowledge on, you know, science and math and literature, and then ignore the right brain aspects, you know, like openness, creativity, empathy, then what happens is the left brain becomes dominant and begins to shut down the right brain, and the internal marriage becomes weak and becomes unhealthy. And this can also lead to chaos, internal chaos, which then leads to external chaos. See? So we have to understand that it's important to fine-tune and continue the balancing act within, individually, so that way there can be a strong manifested outward marriage, if that's, you know, something you're into or something you want to do, and or if something you're in already. And even if someone doesn't get married, if they are maintaining a strong internal marriage, then they are expressing balance in the aggregate of consciousness in the world. They are actually helping. You are actually helping. If you're not married, if you don't have a partner, and you're finding internal balance, if you're having the alchemical marriage within, you are actually helping raise consciousness in this world. You're helping unity express itself in this world, whether you know that or not. And something else I'd like to touch on is the idea that we're not supposed to have intercourse until after marriage. And if we look at this allegorically, then we can see that if the Masonic sacred feminine left and sacred masculine right pillars are balanced, then what happens is there erects this wisdom pillar or the sacred child, which is the sun or action pillar. It is the wedded pillar. So because of the law of mentalism, the idea of waiting to have sex and have a child after marriage is just a manifestation from the inner science of the internal wedding and birth of the sacred child, right? So it's the active pillar, the wisdom pillar, the middle pillar, right? That comes when both hemispheres or both pillars, sacred feminine and sacred masculine, come together to erect that middle pillar, right? And I'm in no way trying to push the idea that anyone should wait till marriage to have intercourse or have children. I'm just stating the internal science. I do think just by understanding this knowledge, it really can help raise children a lot stronger spiritually, especially. But my point is that when we are erect, when both of our pillars or our hemispheres are healthy and they are coming together in an alchemical wedding, this is what generates, it causes the generative, the care to erect that child, to erect that middle pillar spiritually, okay? So this is an internal science. This marriage is an internal science. The allegory of the marriage is an internal science. Okay? So if you're looking at the Entered Apprentice tracing board, Solomon's Temple, this is the allegory for helping us understand the marriage. I mean, all boards, all 3 degrees really are helping us understand this internal marriage, this allegory, because they are allegories of the marriage within. So this is really important. One of the things I want to talk about also that is so fascinating is, since we're on the topic of conception, what I think is really, really wild and such an amazing correspondence is the image that I found back in 2011. Some scientists discovered that sparks of zinc explode at the point of conception, when the sperm meets the egg, right? When the sperm is chosen by the egg and enters the egg. And this is the divine spark, right? The flash of light. So this flash of light was captured in this image that we see on this slide on the right. And we can see the correspondence of the male as the sperm and the female as the egg, where the male is the active principle that comes to the female to ask for marriage, right? Because the egg chooses the sperm. So whatever, sperm comes to the egg, there could be, 10 sperm that come to the egg or more, and it is up to the egg to choose the sperm to come in and conceive. Most people don't know that. They think that the egg or the sperm just like goes right in there, and that's not how it works, because if that were the case, then there would be 20 sperm that made it to the egg would all go in at the same time. That's not how it works. It's only one that makes it. As far as I understand, that's how it works. But anyway, the egg, or the external female, allows for the marriage, or allows for the ring, just as the egg allows for the sperm to enter, right? Or even when even the act of sex, to have sex, to have actual sex intercourse with someone, when a male has intercourse with a female, she has to allow it, right? So it's all corresponding, right? So it's very interesting. It's very, very interesting how it all corresponds. It's really, really amazing. It's just really neat how the solar eclipse ring, diamond ring, looks just like I mean, obviously the diamond ring is inspired by the solar eclipse, and also to see it under the microscope, that's even more solidifying, right? Because they all look the same. They're all the same. You know, when that zinc explodes and there's that divine spark, it's like the sparkle of the diamond or the sparkle of the sun coming around the moon in the solar eclipse. So it's all a marriage dance. It's a generative force. It's a bond of unity, right? And I'll leave a link in the description if you're interested to check out the video of the conception. I think it's really, really fascinating to watch and see that. So this is why the sun impregnates the moon or Mother Mary, right? Because Mother Mary is symbolized by the moon, especially a full moon or fully pregnant moon with the sun. See? So we have to understand that these names of these, what people believe are historical figures, really are just elemental powers in nature. They are actual, you know, orbs in nature when we're talking about Horus or Jesus or Mother Mary or Isis. They're not just, you know, names made up and, you know, made to control people necessarily. They're to help us understand things in nature, to help us understand our spiritual growth. So it's very, very interesting. Now, when we break down the word marriage, we see that it means the union between man and woman for life. Being wedded for life. Between man and woman for life. So it's important that we understand the definitions of where marriage comes from and what it really means, okay? Because to understand its origins, that's where we're really going to understand the word better. But let's look at the word marriage and see the, you know, when we break it down into two words, right? We have the first name being Mary, right? Mary. So think about what I just said with Jesus and Mary, or the sun and the moon, Mary. And then, you know, that being a marriage, the sun and the moon, right? And the second name is age, Mary age, right? So this is some green language, and it's something that I find very powerful about the name Mary. The name Mary comes from Mary, M-A-R-R-Y. So the first name, so the name Mary is M-A-R-Y, but phonetically it's the same as Mary, M-A-R-R-Y, which means marriage. And when we look at the etymology of the name Mary, we find that it means to rebel or rebellion. That's very interesting, right? And rebellion means war waged against government. And government translates to what? Mind control or slavery, right? And then the word age translates to lifetime. So marriage and I would say spiritual marriage, Mary age can mean to be united and rebel against all forms of slavery for life. Because the truth is, when we are truly wedded within individually, we're not great for being slaves, right? Especially spiritually. So we will definitely rebel against control structures that oppress and hold us back from freedom, from union, Because union is what leads to freedom. Internal marriage is what leads to freedom. This is why we are so divided in this world, because we're not internally married. Think about it. You know, think about all the division in this world. You know, you got the religious division between Christians and Muslims. You have the division between atheists and Christians, or the political division between the Democrats and the Republicans, or between fascists and communists, or blacks and whites, or the poor versus the rich, or, you know, it just goes on and on. There's so many divisions. So think about all the marriages, the external marriages that end up in divorce, and all the families that are, you know, no longer families because they live in a divided home or a broken home. And they're all, you know, split up and living in different places of the world. This has all to do with, you know, the controllers and dominators of this world. They know that when we are united within, individually and collectively, then we don't really make for good slaves. They know that we're not going to take their shit. And they know that we will rebel, and that we will take back our freedom and reduce suffering while we're doing that. Because that's what they want. These people, they don't care that others are suffering. They just want to keep us divided, so that way they stay on top and you know, sit on their throne of control. Now, where the marriage takes place within, Masonically, is the middle chamber. And the actual physical place within our brain is the thalamus, which I've kind of covered already, but it means the receptacle of a flower. And from the Latin thalamus, which is spelled the same way, it means inner chamber or sleeping room, which figuratively means marriage or wedlock. So think about that, you know, and what I was talking about, you know, raising consciousness, Kundalini up, you know, going up the spine, you know, going on this inner journey from, you know, falling down to the sacrum and, you know, alchemically growing that seed up to the pineal. That's what this is about. It's about going up and to the thalamus, where the pineal gland is activated. So it's an activated light that ignites this area when the brain hemispheres are wedded and balanced, right? This is about the awakening eye within the oculus. So another correspondence is the human eye that corresponds to the diamond ring, which corresponds to the solar eclipse, especially the solar eclipse. You can really see that if you look at it closely. I put a little eye up there in the top right. You can see how that looks like the solar eclipse, right? So you have the big void, dark part, the pupil, and then you have that little spark of light right there on the edge of that darkness. And then, of course, the color of the eye can also represent the light of the sun behind, right? But it's all a marriage dance. You know, the conception is such a powerful image to see. You know, I mean, that's amazing that we can see that. But that conception helps us see this marriage. You know, all through the universe, you all twinkles of light as masculine, and the dark waters of space is the sacred mother. And it's a dance, the sacred feminine, right? Sacred feminine with the sacred masculine, having a dance, a light and dark, constant, all through the universe. The receptive energy and the penetrative energy, all through the universe. Now, I could get into a lot more about the concept of marriage, but I'm just going to share one more thing that I find to be pretty interesting, and it involves your participation if you want to join. And maybe you already are familiar with this hand marriage ring gesture. And, you know, I'm not saying that I completely believe that this gesture is the origin of the reason for the ring finger, but it does have merit in it. And it is kind of neat because, you know, it does kind of show us something very powerful about ourselves just by using both of our hands. So if you take both your hands, actually go to the next slide that says allegory of marriage, and it says ring finger meaning. Okay. So you're going to put your hand or both your hands together where your, you know, your finger digits are touching. And then what you're going to do is you're going to take your middle fingers and you're going to create a bridge where your knuckles, your middle knuckles meet. So you'll see this kind of bridge in between, like this triangular pattern between your fingers in a way, right? So what this means is your thumbs together represent your parents, both your parents. And your pointer fingers represent your brothers and sisters or your siblings, right? And then the middle fingers represents you being unified within, right? So that's why they're, your middle fingers are pointing back at you. And you're in the middle, right? You're in the middle of all this, right? So then your ring fingers are obviously between you and your partner. But it also can be between, you know, your hemispheres. Your bond between your hemispheres. And then your pinkies represent your offspring with your partner. So if you go back to your thumbs, if you separate, keep all your fingers together, right? And just release, move your thumbs away from each other. And what that represents is that your family, your well, your mother and father can fall away from you at some point in your life, right? Or you move on from them. It doesn't mean that, you know, you don't love them. It doesn't mean that you don't see them anymore. It just means like you've moved on from them. And the same with your siblings, which is your pointer fingers. You can, if you move your pointer, put your thumbs back together, move your pointer fingers away from each other. And this represents the fact that your siblings can also fall away from you. And then obviously your middle fingers just stay together because that's you. You're unified in you. And then your ring fingers, if you try to move them away from each other, at least from my experience and from other people, it is impossible to move them away from each other. If all other fingers are touching, you can't move them away from each other, right? And that symbolizes the bond of eternal marriage, right? That's why the finger, that's why the ring goes on that finger, because it is the bonding finger between you and your partner, or between your hemispheres of the brain, right? And then the pinky fingers, you can move those away from each other. And that just means that your children, your offspring, can, if you have any, they can move away from you. They can fall away from you, or, you know, they can move on, right? So, or you can grow apart. So basically, when you're marrying someone, you're, you know, that's why the vow is like from death. What is it? How's it go? Death do us part. Well, that's what this is kind of representing. It's representing the internal marriage and the external marriage, because that's what it's about. It's about the ring finger is the finger that is showing us how it can't be separated once there's a bond, right? So, yeah, anyway, that's a very interesting little thing about the ring finger that I wanted to share. And I know some of you probably think it's silly and maybe there's nothing to it. But I mean, it does kind of say something, and I think there is merit to it, like I said. So anyway, let's move on to aliens, UFOs, and grays. And I think this is a very, very interesting take that I have that I'm going to present, because I think that a lot of people are very stuck in looking externally for aliens. And, you know, there's many ways to approach this concept. So, you know, I just want to start out by saying, or, you know, I really want to be very clear that I'm only going to give my take on the allegory of this concept, okay? And what I'm not going to do is get into actual events or sightings or any other stories. And I'm also in no way denying what people have actually seen. I do believe there is other life forms out there, and I find many stories to be highly fascinating, and I even believe some of that stuff. But what I'm going to share in this part is what I believe needs to be understood universally, allegorically, about ETs and UFOs and aliens first, okay? We need to understand this concept from the angle of consciousness if we're really going to make any real headway towards freedom or towards elevating consciousness, okay? I do believe that the UFO community is very open-minded, but not enough people are really thinking about this concept from the philosophical or allegorical perspective, okay? So I'm going to put down some important definitions that I feel need to be addressed, just so we're clear on a few things. So make sure to go to the slide that says allegory, aliens, UFOs, and grays. These are, and it says important definitions to consider. And I'm pretty sure most that are listening already understand these definitions, but I think it's important to address them to see more of the spiritual allegory aspect in them. Okay, so let's start off by asking the question, what is an alien? Well, one of the definitions that I think states this the best says that it is strange or foreign, right? And from Old French, alien means strange or foreign. As a noun, alien, stranger, foreigner, from Latin, alienus, of or relating to another, not one's own. Foreign, strange. Okay, that's one definition, and it's really interesting that it says of or belonging to another. You know, that could mean being a slave, right? So, yeah, it's very interesting. But again, I'm just putting these definitions down just so we understand what these things are. Okay, so we have a better understanding of what I'm saying when I'm introducing this allegory. Now, what is an ET or an extraterrestrial? Well, extra means outside or beyond the scope of, in addition to what is usual or expected, right? So it's unusual, beyond and unusual, right? And then terrestrial means of or pertaining to the earth. So it's earthly. So ET means beyond the earthly, right? So you could say that the planets and the stars are ETs, right? Because they're all beyond the earthly. They're all beyond the terrestrial, right? Now, what is a UFO? A UFO is, I think everybody knows this one, unidentified flying object, right? So it doesn't mean that it is something from... That is an ET. It doesn't mean that it's an ET. It just means it's something that We don't know. It can't be identified. It's unidentified. So whenever we're using this word or term or acronym, UFO, that's what we're saying. That's what people are saying. So whenever I hear someone saying they saw a UFO, I don't get all bent out of shape and be like, oh my God, they're conspiracy theorists and they're just seeing things. No, I've seen things flying in the air that didn't look like they were, from this planet. Because it's something I've never seen before. So it's a UFO. It has nothing to do with thinking that there's little, you know, green men or gray people in those flying objects. It has nothing to do with that. But also when people are using UFO in a way where they believe that there are little green men or grays in there, that can be kind of a problem too, you know, because yeah, it's like, well, now you're just believing something that where you have no, nothing to back it up, you know? So now what is the well-known gray alien or what's known as the grays? So this is what has been recorded as gray-skinned, small human-like, humanoid-like beings that possesses reduced forms of or completely lack external human body parts like noses, ears, or sex organs. And their bodies are reported as being elongated, having a small chest, and lacking muscular definition and visible skeletal structure. Their legs are supposedly shorter and jointed different from humans, and they typically have a large balloon head and giant black eyes. Okay. Now, I feel that we have some important points by stating these definitions, just so we know what we're getting into here. Okay. And again, I'm not dismissing the idea of aliens, but we have to look at this through the spiritual allegorical lens if we're really going to get anywhere, if this really even matters to anybody, you know? So let's go to the slide that says allegory of beam and flying saucer with the guy getting beamed up. So when we think allegorically about how we can understand these ideas a lot further, especially the classical ideas. So, you know, let's start with the idea of, well, where do aliens or ETs, extraterrestrials, typically come from? You know, do they come from other planets or the stars? Or the sky, the clouds, you know, that's typically where we know them to come from or where people have said that they come from, right? Supposedly, right? They typically come down, you know, how the reports are, they typically come down from the celestial to the terrestrial, right? They come from the cosmos down to Earth. They come from the stars down to Earth. And what do many people and Hollywood movies tell us about what they do typically when they see us humans? What happens is, typically, they shine a light down on the human to do what? Beam them up. And this is akin to the unknown alien knowledge that we stumble upon. That is a bright light of truth, you know, the painful light that hits us in the head that's hard to look at and accept, right? Because, you know, when a human being is getting beamed up into a spaceship, you can see in their face, like especially in the movies, or even in stories that people have told, that the light is so bright and they have trouble looking up at it. I mean, obviously any light that is, you know, hitting you right in the face is going to be hard to face, right? It's going to be hard to look directly at. But anyway, it raises us up. You know, the beam of light raises us up. So the understanding of this alien or unknown knowledge, this unknown, you know, the unidentified, you know, knowledge, you could call it that, right? But it is the unconscious becoming conscious because it's being raised. It's about a being raised. It's about a being raised. Because it's literally a being raised. And the flying saucer or UFO is typically in the shape of an eye, right? So it's about being raised to the pineal, right? It's about being raised up Jacob's ladder or the spiral staircase up to the thalamus or throne of the pine cone, right? So this is why you'll also see a spiral vortex sometimes within that beam of light in many, you know, artists' renditions or movies. So then what typically happens when the human is raised into the spaceship or UFO? They're typically examined by grays or humanoid ETs, right? And grays are akin to the telencephalon, the gray matter of the human brain. That's what they are. They're a brain. This is why they have giant heads. This represents intelligence and where they're at. You know, that's why their bodies are small, because they're mostly just brains. You know, so it represents a big balloon head brain. And this is also why they don't have any sex organs, because they're higher order beings. They don't operate from the lower terrestrial world, right? So this is about the self raising above the material plane, away from base desires and sexual lower acts, right? It's about the gray matter of the brain being activated by this raised part of the self. And the huge, pitch black pupils of these beings that they're using is to study the human, because it's all about the sight of the oculus, the eye of the occult. And they're inside the spaceship. They are the eyes that see inside the spaceship. The spaceship is the head, right? So we're beaming up. You know, this is all akin to what I was saying with, you know, going up. You know, this is like the Kundalini energy going up to the skull, right? Up to the Golgotha, right? Up to the middle part of the skull, to the thalamus. You're raising. This is about raising us up in the beam of light up to the gray matter, where the eye sees. The eye is becoming, the eye is looking at what has been raised in us. So it's about consciousness. So this is like being raised to the higher temple rungs of the self, the inner part of the self. But the grays studying the human and doing the test is simply the self doing inner tests and inner studies, because it's inner studies on the self. So it's really that simple, because it's dealing with the unseen, which is alien. That's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the unseen, the alien. It's foreign to us. And we can even look at this in the same way with psilocybin, you know, mushrooms, magical mushrooms. If we look at the cap as the UFO, the saucer, the flying saucer, and then the stem as the beam of light, and then realize that these substances are beings. I really do believe that mushrooms are beings. They're very intelligent beings. And they, you know, actually have the ability to lead us to a trip through the cosmos. You know, like as if we're, you know, taken by aliens to other parts of the universe. Because the trip of taking psilocybin is always alien to us, right? It's always foreign. There's always these mushrooms are always showing something different when they're taken, especially in higher dosages. And also, you know, magical mushrooms are typically gray in color, right? You know, especially when they've been kind of, you know, dried out, but they're gray in color, right? So it's all a correspondence. So there's this allegory of this beaming of a being up to a flying saucer, because it's about igniting the eye. It's about becoming conscious. And that's what all three of these images that I'm sharing here on this slide, it's all about raising consciousness. It's all about becoming conscious. It's about raising to the higher self. So obviously, I would say in the left picture that I made, that's about knowledge. To ignite the pineal and become more conscious means that you're taking in knowledge. And you're able to make the connections and see symbolically, see allegorically, see morally. But then, you know, if you take mushrooms, that can help you get there. But you're not really going to, everything is really alien to you when you're looking at it, right? Because it's not something that you really understand what you're seeing, but the mushroom is showing you what you need to see. You know, the psilocybin is showing you what you need to see. It's helping you see something that maybe you need to work on, or maybe you need to study more, or maybe you need to go towards, or maybe you need to think about more. So it's about understanding that it's all about the expansion of consciousness. Now, I want to go back to the beam spiral of light, the peak point. So the peak point represents the most high, and the beam of light is typically conical in shape, right? I've seen many conical lights in different movies and in, you know, artists' renditions. So when reaching or raising up to the spaceship or UFO or flying saucer, however you want to call it, this symbolically represents the self reaching the most high, right? A place unknown and hard to understand, you know, what's happening, right? So on the next slide that says middle fire to the most high, you know, this is stuff that I've been talking about. This is stuff that Doug and Brandon have been talking about so many times during this show and in other presentations, but I just want to make mention of it here. So if we study the Egyptian pyramids through the occult, through Freemasonry, we'll see that the lunar pyramid, being the southern smaller pyramid on the right, and the northern pyramid on the left, the solar pyramid, and then the middle pyramid being the seven or the stellar pyramid. This is about understanding this sacred union, you know, so we can understand the marriage. This is where the marriage is taking place. This is how we're supposed to understand these pyramids. And I made this image with east, north, west, and south, so that way you can stay oriented and understand. And, you know, Pyra mid, the fire in the middle, it's about raising that energy up in the vortex up to the seven, right? So it's about raising from the heart up to the most high, right? Because it's about understanding that the heart and mind are one, yes, but it's about understanding that once we have that marriage, that union, this is where we are going to raise the fire. The fire is going to help us raise. The fire of the marriage is going to help us raise up to this place of the unknown. And this can be understood by studying the stellar mythos, because they stored all things seven in the Little Bear, in the Ursa Minor, in the Little Dipper, the seven stars. You know, Polaris being the tip of the tail of the Little Bear, right? So it's all stored in that point. That is the Most High. Those stars are symbolic of the Most High, and that is a place that is very alien to us. But if we study the stellar mythos, we will be raised by that middle fire. When we have the internal marriage, we will be raised. If we're really doing the great work, if we're really going back far enough and strengthening that marriage all the way back to the stellar, you know, do the work on the solar, do the work on the lunar of the self, bring those together to have that solar eclipse. That's where we're going to raise to the seven, to understand all things seven being stored in the Little Bear. Because that is the place where it is so alien to our species. That's where we're really going to learn why we are so divided. Because that is the Most High. So if we have that fire in the middle, you know, that solar fire in the heart, and that lunar energy, that lunar care in the heart together, this is what makes that divine spark to the Most High. And this is part of understanding the Philosopher's Stone, which I'm going to get into on future shows. But this is all about going in the direction of East to the Most High. And we have to stay oriented so that way we know that once we have merged these hemispheres enough, once we are really truly at the pyramid, the fire in the middle, and we have raised to see this enormous symbolic structure of the Most High and feel it and understand how valuable it is and how important it is to become conscious of it, this is literally like being beamed up into a spaceship that takes you to that star, to those stars. Because that's what, you know, we're so caught up in literalizing everything that we're not seeing the true magic of Earth and the true magic of geometry and the true magic of symbolism and the true magic of storytelling. You know, we've got away from all that because it's like, oh, it's all just in your imagination. It's all just, you know, hoopla. And there's nothing to it. No, it takes us back. It brings us back and unifies us with our elders. This is what's going to help us understand where things went wrong in the past. And I know a lot of what I'm saying is very difficult for people to wrap their head around, because if you're not versed in especially Freemasonry, and not thinking allegorically, this can be very difficult for someone to understand. But we have to, if we really truly care, if we really are truly merging our hemispheres, we will understand this. Because this is the higher forms of the wedding. Because we're trying to reach that most high, not just... I mean, see, here's the thing is, once we find the symbolic reference of the Most High, then we can see it within ourselves. We can recognize the Most High is within. So that's what these pyramids are helping us do if we are paying attention enough. And a lot of people think that aliens made the pyramids or slaves made the pyramids. It doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, it does matter in to a degree because, yeah, that technology is important, or the mindset, or the way that it was done, you know, the methods. Yeah, of course, that is important. But compared to why those pyramids were built, then it's always going to stay alien to us. It's always going to stay unidentified. It's always going to stay, you know, we're always going to be playing in that world of it was ETs that built the pyramids. But if we really understand the why, we'll get away from that. It doesn't mean that, you know, these things didn't happen. And you, if you want to keep, you know, wondering if that was the case, if that's what came to Earth and built the pyramids, fine. But at least try to understand the spiritual allegory and science and symbolism of the pyramids. Try to understand that first, because that is the foundation. This is all about natural law. This is about morality. And once we understand that, once we understand that the pyramid builders stored all this information within these pyramids, and then they knew that the pyramids could be destroyed, so they stored the information in the sun, the moon, and the Little Dipper. Those are the most important, as far as I know, the most important celestial orbs and constellation in the universe for us to understand. Now, obviously, there's a lot of other constellations we should definitely consider and study, and yes, they're very important. But the three that I'm talking about are extremely important to understanding the Most High, because that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to understand the Most High. We're trying to understand why so many people, like at the beginning of the show, where Doug says, you know, who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who's the Most High? Right? Because man is playing God, right? Man is trying to be Most High on the earth. And when man is trying to be God or the Most High, then it's because man, who has knowledge, who is a psychopath dominator trying to control others, has this, you know, knowledge power differential and gets people to believe that man can be the ruler and can be the Most High. You know, most people don't know man to be Most High as a dominator, but that's what man is trying to be God, trying to be the Most High, trying to dominate the world by using occulted knowledge. So by exposing this occulted knowledge, by becoming aware, by becoming conscious of it, we are slowly but surely moving in the direction of freedom, because we're becoming sovereign, we're becoming beings that are not going to be dominated by knowledge that we don't have access to. Now, obviously, there's a lot of knowledge that we don't have access to, sure. But we I believe that we have enough now, especially with the foundation of natural law. We definitely have enough to go in the right direction, at least. And by understanding the pyramids, we really do have even more knowledge that's beneficial to freedom. But, you know, it's up to you. It's up to each one of us to really see how important this is. So, you know, what happens when you have this knowledge and you're trying to bring it back to the people? You know, what I consider to be the true great work when you're coming back down the mountain to help others see. Because, you know, the mountain is also akin to a pyramid. You know, when you're getting to the top, when you're raising to the top, right? You're going from the bottom to the top of the pyramid. Now you're going back down to put your hand out to help others. Okay, well, what typically happens when aliens or ETs come down to Earth or, you know, to the terrestrial, from the celestial to the terrestrial? They're typically not really welcomed, right? I mean, you see this literally and in movies and in books and stories, right? They're demonized or they're shot down or they're ridiculed or they're shunned by the people, right? Typically, right? So the masses don't like those of us who speak alien knowledge to them, right? Meaning they resist pretty much anyone speaking truth because truth is so alien and it goes against their programmed beliefs. So as anyone speaks about the occult and the hidden sciences, this is what people fear and why they, you know, become deniers and crucifiers. And something really interesting about that is when I was really young, I would say maybe 4 or 5 years old, I drew a gray alien on the cross being burned. I had no idea what I was drawing until I got older and remembered that drawing and found that drawing. I don't know where it is now, unfortunately. But it's interesting because when, you know, God, when little kids are drawing crazy stuff, like demonic looking or crazy, people tend to, especially parents, they worry. They think, you know, oh no, my kid, especially like these Christian extremists, they typically are like, oh, you know, something's wrong with my kid. I got to take him to get seen, or maybe they need to be put on medication or something like that. But no. Children should never, ever be taken to a shrink or to, you know, be put on medication or demonized or, you know, physically assaulted just because they're, you know, because I've heard of children being spanked on the hand for drawing such, you know, crazy drawings. But see, children don't know what they're drawing. They're just drawing what they feel to, because they don't have the knowledge to express what they're feeling inside. And so they make art to express themselves. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the most beautiful things that any human being could ever wake up to, is when you draw, you are expressing something that is deep within you that you can't put into words. I mean, obviously, when you get older and you're able to put things in words, you might kind of stray away from expressing through art. But when I was a child, I used to express all kinds of crazy stuff. Some stuff I'm not going to get into, but one of the things I drew was an alien, a gray alien on the cross. So in the place of Jesus with fire. And so how I would interpret that now is that when I was younger, there was so much that I was exposed to as a child that I think what I was trying to say was, there is this being that is trying to help us. Whether, you know, it's just someone who's trying to help and they are being crucified like the character or like the archetypal figure known as Jesus. They're just trying to help and then they're crucified. Well, what does Jesus represent to most people? Why do they hate Jesus so much? Well, because Jesus is very alien to them, right? And they want to burn the alien at the cross. They want to burn you. They want to burn the truth because T, the cross, equals truth. So Jesus equals truth. Jesus equals light. Well, alien is light. Alien is truth because, I mean, you can look at it that way. You know, there's other ways to look at aliens, but I'm expressing how I'm in trying to interpret what I was trying to say from as a young child. And it's very interesting now that I understand what alien means, at least in, from my perspective. That's how I see it. Because, I mean, why else would anyone want to demonize, Jesus if Jesus was so trying to bring so much peace and love into the world, right? Why Jesus was trying to help us understand, was or is trying to help us understand something that is very powerful in ourselves. And, you know, how could people just demonize that? It doesn't make any sense. But I mean, the thing is I understand now what I was trying to tell myself in the future is that Jesus is alien. The information of Jesus is alien and people want to burn it just like burning the book, right? They want to get rid of that. They want to book burn or witches want to burn or burn the witch at the stake, right? You know, so then I decided to look up to see if anybody else, because, you know, I don't want to think of myself as the only one who saw something like that. So I went online and I looked up alien on the cross. And I was blown away by how many drawings there are of aliens, gray aliens on the cross. And if you don't believe me, go look it up. So I was tapped into something very, very young, something I saw at a very young age, because I was trying to express something that I knew nothing about, but I saw it, you know? So there's no coincidence that so many people have drawn that. And it's very interesting, very, very interesting. So, anyway, people fear the unseen, which is why UFOs are so rare and they're barely seen, right? So trying to, you know, bring knowledge of the seven to the people is basically like aliens or men from the stars that are trying to bring the solution to the people who are mostly not ready or just simply won't accept that solution. And men from the stars, you know, the way that I understand it, it translates to men who know the universe. Men who study the universe, men who understand the Hermetic principles, men who understand natural law, men who understand the unseen realm, men who understand the constellations, men who understand the mystery traditions, the universe, men who know the universe. That's who the materialists are afraid of. And something else that I thought of is that raising into higher forms of consciousness is alien to us individually. And, you know, maybe like aliens, we may be able to achieve communication through the mind only. Right? But I also can look at that as like the language of the birds. It's something that we can communicate without sounding like we're communicating. But, you know, maybe telepathy really is, I do believe in telepathy. I feel like I've had it with a cow and a dolphin, but, you know, I don't know. I haven't really studied it deeply. I don't really know enough about the science behind it, and I definitely don't dismiss it. But I do think that there is something to, you know, the mind being so advanced that there might be a way where we can communicate without speaking or without symbols or without writing. So, and I mean, you know, I do realize that there are ways that we do that, but I'm talking about, you know, a very specific way to communicate with the mind, something that I'm not conscious of. And maybe it really is something that certain people know about. Maybe it comes as we become even more conscious. I'm not sure. But I do think that that's kind of what the alien form is telling us, because it seems like that's the way that they communicate in a certain way, right? You know, through the stories and through the comics and through the, you know, the books. And a really great allegory for all of this that I'm talking about with, you know, the man coming down from the stars, or aliens coming down in a UFO or some kind of flying saucer. If you haven't seen the movie, or I'm sorry, the show, the series, Twilight Zone, definitely look up the episode called The Gift. If you haven't seen that episode, definitely watch that episode. It is excellent at expressing what I'm trying to convey in an allegory, because, you know, Twilight Zone is just all allegories. But that's one of my favorite episodes. That really just blew my mind. But definitely watch that. I think you're really going to be in for a treat if you haven't done so already. So, and I think before I get off here, I just wanted to say, I wanted to do a little green language with alien, the word alien. So the word alien is A-L-I-E-N, right? Alien. And then A-L could be all, A-L-L, all. And then I can be E-Y-E. And then E-N can be I-N, right? So all I-N, because all, the all, is mind. The universe is mental. The whole all, or the whole, or the all, I, is inward. Think about it. It's the occult. It's the unseen. It's alien to us. But we can become conscious of the unconscious. The unconscious is the alien. You know, that's the way I'm seeing it, okay? So hopefully you guys are seeing or resonating with what I'm saying. I know a lot of people might have some trouble with some of the things I have said, and that's okay. I'm just putting it out on the table. I mean, that's where I'm at in consciousness. And I do think that it is a good place in the show to put this type of information. There's a lot more allegories, foundational allegories that I'd like to talk about in the future. But again, I've said this before. I really hope that Brandon and Doug and I come up with a spinoff show of the Cubbyhole where we're just breaking down allegories in video format. That would be really cool. But that is on the back burner. And, you know, it is something that I would love to be part of, but, you know, I'm running two shows. I'm running the Cubbyhole and I'm running the Outcasting show. So it's a lot of work. and I'm doing my best to put out some really good content, but you know, we'll get there when we get there. So one more thing I wanted to say before I get off here is, you know, if you look at these allegories with the help of, you know, the entered apprentice, you know, think about the Darwin theory, evolution theory, you know, you're entering the world, right? The entered apprentice, you're entering the world of the occult, you're entering the world of true education, right? To evolve into a higher self, into a higher type. And then you have the second degree, which is all about the heart and marriage, right? So you can look at that as, well, that's an allegory for marriage, you know, going into the middle chamber. And then you can look at the third degree being raised, you know, raised up, you know, raised in the beam of light from your lower self to your higher self, to your newer self, to your, you know, where you're coming out a new person on the other end because the aliens have really messed you up. Well, not messed you up, but like they really woke you up to, they really shocked you into your new self, if you want to look at it that way. But I'm not going to get too far into that. I really do want to break down the third degree as thorough as possible. And, you know, that's the direction that we're going into the next show. So definitely stay tuned for that. And hopefully you guys have a wonderful Christmas and New Year's if you celebrate those things. And, you know, hopefully things start to, I do think that things are turning around for the good in a lot of ways. And, I'm trying to be as optimistic as possible, but it's very difficult. So I just hope that everyone listening is, learning a lot and, gaining something from what's being shared on these shows. And, I'll be on soon in the next year, and hopefully you guys find some peace, and I hope everybody the best. So that being said, I thank you for tuning in and giving your time and attention. If you're interested in more shows and news and presentations, please go to cubbyhole.com. Also, make sure to check out my new video show, Outcasting, where I do short episodes explaining many different critical topics, a lot more simplified and more refined. And I'm definitely going to be putting out some really important shows here in the near future, especially I'm going to do some animated hermetic principles, and I'm also going to get into polarization dialectics and how important it is to understand the brain and why we're all so divided. So definitely something to look forward to. And if you have any questions regarding the topics for these shows, please email me at cubbyhole@mail.com. And that is it, guys. I'm your host, Nate Kapp. Thank you for listening. And keep in mind to do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.